from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. If we don't act on climate change now, in about 50 years, San Francisco could see as many as 30 above 90-degree days annually, and that's according to a new report by the Union of Concerned Scientists. And for areas of the country that are already hot, the report, titled Killer Heat, projects staggeringly high heat conditions of 127 degrees or more in 20 years. We'll discuss a report which is the first county-by-county assessment of how climate change will affect temperature and humidity levels in the U.S. in coming decades. And that's next, after this news. Welcome to this morning's Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. If we don't manage to reduce carbon emissions quickly to slow climate change, it's going to get awfully hot here in the Bay Area and throughout the United States. A report released today by the Union of Concerned Scientists projects that in 5 decades, San Francisco could have 30 days per year where the heat index is above 90. That's when the temperature and the humidity combine to make it feel like 90. That makes for dangerous conditions for vulnerable people, and projections are far more extreme for other parts of California and the United States. And joining us to first talk about extreme heat and its effects is Christina Dahl. She's here with us in studio. She's senior climate scientist for Climate and Energy Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists and lead author of the new report, which is called Killer Heat. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. And we're talking about heat in terms of temperature and humidity. They kind of blend together here. It feels like a temperature.
That's right. So when it comes to how our bodies experience heat, the reading on the thermometer is just one part of it. And the humidity is a really important part of the equation, because as the humidity rises, it gets harder and harder for sweat to evaporate off our skin, which is ultimately what cools us when we're hot.
We're talking about also extreme heat here. That's essentially, from your measurements and your projections, going to be rapid and widespread throughout the United States, not only here in California.
That's right. We predict really staggering changes in the frequency and severity of extreme heat across the U.S. if we fail to reduce our carbon emissions.
And we're going to talk about the health effects of this, but different heat indexes have different thresholds. And we also, I think, need to take into account here the fact that we've got at least some suggestion of what might be done about this. New Mexico Senator Tom Udall has put forward a REC Act of 2019, which is a Renewable Energy Standard Act. And the idea here is to cut 50%, to cut 50% with renewables.
That's right. Many states, like New Mexico,
carbon cut 50%. Yeah.
Like New Mexico, as you just mentioned, in California, we also passed a bill last year that has us getting 100% of our electricity from clean sources by the middle of the century.
And the Union of Concerned Scientists are saying what here, that senators ought to particularly feel the heat from the citizenry in terms of getting something done along the lines that Senator Udall's put forward?
We hope that this work that we've done speaks to a lot of different audiences. For the general public, thinking about the heat wave that's predicted for much of the country for this summer, we'd like people to start to see what's coming down the pike in terms of more frequent events like the one we'll have this week. But we also hope it's really useful for, like you said, the policymakers who are ultimately making the decisions about the type of energy that we produce and how we cut our emissions in the future.
Well, let's talk about California first, and maybe we can look at some more of what we've learned from these projections throughout the country. But we're not just talking about deserts and the Central Valley in California. We're talking about the whole state. And let's focus for the moment on the Bay Area. Can you give us some numbers here?
Absolutely. So California has an incredibly varied climate. We've got our cool coastal cities and our interior areas that are a lot warmer. So those general patterns will still hold in the future, but we'll start to see almost all the counties in the Bay Area having much more frequent, much more severe heat, even by the middle of this century. So for example, Napa County historically has had about a month's worth of days where the heat index exceeds 90 degrees. And by mid-century, if our emissions continue to rise, Napa County would see roughly double that number, about 2 months of days where the heat index is above 90. We see similar changes for Solano County, Alameda County is projected to experience a tripling in the number of days above 90 by mid-century. So these are really huge changes in a part of the country that is famously cool and comfortable.
Christina Dahl is here with us. She's senior climate scientist for the Climate and Energy Program with the Union of Concerned Scientists and lead author of a new report called Killer Heat. Let me go to Linda Rudolph, who's joining us. She's senior advisor on climate change and health with the Public Health Institute. And welcome, Linda Rudolph. Good to have you aboard.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Let's find out from you about what we're talking specifically about the impact of climate on health, and particularly climate change leading to, well, right now, in fact, leading cause of death among climate causes. But we're especially talking about vulnerable populations here, young, old, homeless, and so forth. Can you give us a picture?
Yeah, well, as you said, heat is the leading climate-related cause of death, and people often underestimate just how severe a heat wave can be. In 2006, there was a heat wave in California that actually caused about 655 excess deaths, and the 2003 heat wave in Europe caused over 70,000 deaths. So the people that are the most vulnerable to excess heat are older adults who don't adjust as well to sudden changes in temperature, people that have chronic medical conditions like diabetes or heart disease, people that are overweight, people that use some prescription drugs that make them more sensitive to heat, and the very young children. And then there's things in people's environment that make them more vulnerable to heat. So people that live in urban heat islands that have a lot of pavement, not a lot of trees, not a lot of green space, those areas can be as much as 22 degrees higher than surrounding areas, really increasing the risk. People that live in buildings that don't have air conditioning, people that have low income that are afraid to turn on their air conditioning because of the expense of electricity. And in general, we find that African-Americans and Latinos are more likely to live in these urban heat islands. And then people that are at risk because they're working outdoors in very hot conditions, especially farm workers, but also...
Well, I was just thinking about construction workers. Yeah. I mean, this could have a big effect on productivity and on the economy.
Yes, it can. And we know that even when there's not a severe heat wave, that rising temperatures do cause declines in labor productivity. So this really impacts the entire economy.
Plus, the body just can't regulate a lot of this heat. I mean, we're talking about heat illness and heat stroke, which, of course, can be fatal. But we're looking at cardiovascular disease exacerbating, too, and all the stress on the heart and lungs with the elderly and those who have pre-existing conditions. I mean, we're talking about some pretty dramatic impacts, to put it mildly.
Correct. And, you know, we've seen it, again, just as an example, in California's 2006 heat wave, in addition to all of those excess deaths, we had, about 16,000 additional emergency room visits and a tenfold increase in hospital admissions for heat-related illness. So that's another way in which we see these real economic costs of heat.
Linda, can you tell us, we're talking again with Linda Rudolph, Senior Advisor on Climate Change and Health with the Public Health Institute. What does this mean for the Bay Area? Are we less prepared for heat than other regions?
We're less prepared than regions that are more used to heat. So people acclimate to heat physiologically. That's why we see more heat illness at the very beginning of summer when people haven't had that chance for adapting to heat physiologically. But we also see that people make social and cultural and building adaptations. So not very many people in the Bay Area have at least the cooler parts of the Bay Area. Most people don't have air conditioning because we haven't needed it. So we need to think about what can we do to be prepared, and that means not just as individuals, but also as communities, in terms of really looking at, you know, do we have shade for our bus stops so that seniors that use bus stops aren't going to be out in the sun during a heat wave.
And let me go back, if I may, just for a moment to Christina Dahl on this, because the Union of Concerned Scientists, and you're the lead author on this, has said essentially the magnitude could be even greater than the numbers you're putting out, right?
There is that possibility. So we looked at three different scenarios for future climate change, one in which our carbon emissions continue to increase through the end of the century, and that's the path that's most closely aligned to the path that we're on today. We also looked at a scenario where emissions start to decline around mid-century, and then one where we rapidly reduce our emissions and limit future global warming. But those are just hypothetical scenarios, and so they are intended to capture the range that scientists think is likely for our carbon emissions trajectory in the future. But there's always wild cards out there.
Well, maybe the wildest card of all is the president who says global warming, or has said global warming is a hoax. It's made up by the Chinese. I mean, what do you do to those who say you're just working with projections here? We don't know necessarily if we should put faith in these projections.
I think people often have questions about how climate models are used and what the uncertainties are when we use those models. So in our study, we looked at 18 different climate models. And we did that because any one climate model might run a little hot or a little cold, and you don't just want to take the results of one. So that's why we looked at 18 of them. Before we made our future projections for what the heat index would be like, we compared historical runs from those models. So essentially asking the models to try to reproduce the second half of the 20th century and then comparing that to what we actually observed. So what we found was that the models did really well. When it comes to people thinking that, you know, climate change isn't real or isn't happening, I would point to the fact that these are observations of our global temperatures that have shown that we've already warmed by about a degree, close to 2 degrees.
Since you looked at 2, 4, and 8, I believe, didn't you?
That's right. We looked at future warming of 2 degrees Celsius, 4 degrees Celsius, or 8 degrees Celsius.
And if we're going to manage this, we've got to limit ourselves to 2. That goes without saying, but I've said it anyway. And let me bring Molly Peterson aboard. She's science reporter for KQED News. Good morning, Molly.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Can you say something about this in terms of what we might be able to speculate with this growing heat in terms of wildfires and the potential for wildfires?
Well, I mean, I can tell you that in the Bay Area, various counties are responding in different ways to this challenge and thinking about the risks, not just to health, but also to wildfires, to transportation systems, to, you know, there's these ripple effects of heat that might exist. We already see, for example, in Arizona, that it's difficult for planes to take off at a certain temperature, right? So in California, in Northern California, what that might mean is impacts to transit systems. In San Mateo County, they're looking at what might happen if transit systems are warped or otherwise damaged by heat. Does that create delays? Are there going to be secondary and tertiary effects there? And then in terms of wildfires, CAL FIRE says that this is a statewide, this is a, you know, a risk multiplier to have heat on top of the risk of wildfire. So, you know, even in temperate counties, this is a concern.
It's almost looking as if by century's end, if you read this report and grasp or conceptualize what's in it, there's not going to be any refuge here except maybe mountainous regions. And we're talking about extreme heat here, Molly, but I want to actually find out from you, if I could, about where you think this is going to go in terms of policy, or ought to go.
Well, Linda has some things to say about that, too, I would imagine. But what I would say is that I've looked at this in Northern California and in Southern California. I built sensors and also borrowed sensors from academics and measured heat and humidity in people's homes and at people's workplaces. And what we see also, in addition to all the information that scientists like, you know, the Union of Concerned Scientists are gathering, is this great inequality in how heat is distributed on this urban landscape. And that's a big concern, too. And it's not clear how we're going to resolve that. Are we going to resolve that through housing policy? In Los Angeles, the city of Los Angeles takes actions like try to cool down roofs and pavement and plant more trees. Even just understanding tree canopy is something that a lot of different counties can do around the state of California.
And let me at this point give listeners an opportunity to weigh in here. You may have some thoughts about this. I'm sure many of you do, and some questions or comments. We do welcome your involvement in the program, and you can join us now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. That number again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Also, you can get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email questions to forum at kqed.org. We're talking with Christina Dahl, who's Senior Climate Scientist for the Union of Concerned Scientists and lead author of a new report called Killer Heat. And Linda Rudolph is also with us, Senior Advisor on Climate Change and Health with the Public Health Institute. And Molly Peterson, Science Reporter with KQED News. Let me go back to you, Christina, for a moment, and then we'll get our listeners involved in this. Just interested in finding out from you about a mapping tool that's available to listeners and can be embedded.
Absolutely. We've developed an interactive mapping tool that you can find at our website, which is ucsusa.org/killerheat. And when you go to that website, you'll be able to click on an interactive map, explore different heat index thresholds that are meaningful to human health, and see how the results look for your county. We also have a widget where you can input your
That's
location.
Not embedded yet, though, is it?
That one's not embeddable, unfortunately, but you can play around with it at our website. Enter your location and see how the forecast looks for the rest of the century.
Well, the forecast looks, let's get into this in a little more detail with you. We got an average of 40 days probably per year with heat index actually topping 90 degrees Fahrenheit, and we've got some worker safety thresholds in this. Let's talk about that in terms of what you're projecting.
Absolutely. So according to OSHA, when the heat index rises above 90 degrees or so, workers, particularly outdoor workers who are exposed to direct sunlight, need to take additional precautions. And so we looked at how the frequency of days where there would be danger to outdoor workers would change in the future. So as a state average, today we have about 40 days that cross that worker safety threshold. By mid-century, that could rise to 68 days per year. So we're talking about almost an additional month's worth of conditions that are harmful to the health of outdoor workers.
I mentioned before the RES Act of 2019, the Renewable Energy Standard Act, which would go toward 50% renewables. And we're talking about really all renewables here, the whole package of them. Right now, you got 29 states. You had alluded before, of course, California is one of them. And there's a pretty good track record, isn't there?
We are. In California, we came in ahead of our targets that we had set, I believe, for the year 2020 in terms of adopting renewable standards. So in the short and medium term, as we're thinking about how we're going to get to 100% clean electricity by the middle of the century, we need to make sure that we're able to turn down the gas at our power plants and transition to renewables.
And let me transition to our callers, and we begin with the caller. Robin, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, my name is Robin Cooper, and I'm a psychiatrist and am a co-founder of Climate Psychiatry Alliance. And I wanted to add to the discussion some of the mental health impacts that are less well known, with behavioral impacts of increased violence, increased suicide, impaired thinking, and the very special vulnerability of people with psychiatric illnesses who have an increased mortality and increased hospitalizations, and that the medications that are used in psychiatry often make an additional burden for mental health patients to be able to tolerate heat. And I thought that that was a piece of information about the health impacts that are less well understood and known.
I think it's a very important piece of information. Linda Rudolph, can I get you to comment?
Yeah, that's clearly important. The mental health impacts are well known. I also just want to address this concept that the health impacts of climate change are something that we need to worry about in the future. In fact, the health impacts of climate change are happening right now across the country here in California. And just a few weeks ago, nearly 100 leading health and medical organizations across the United States, including the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, issued a call to action on climate health and equity, saying climate change is a health emergency, that it's one of the greatest threats to health that America has ever faced, and that we really need urgent action, not just in our energy system, but also in our transportation system and in our food and agriculture system and in our healthcare system.
Can you talk about what sort of urgent action you would point listeners toward here, if you would, Linda Rudolph?
Yeah, I encourage people to look at www.climatehealthaction.org that has our entire policy action agenda that's been endorsed by all of these health and medical organizations. But basically, we need to do everything that we can to stop using fossil fuels, to get more people walking, biking, and using public transit, as Christina said, to switch to renewable energy. We need to be thinking about what we eat and how we produce our food, so that we're not using embedded fossil fuel energy in our food production. We need to really be thinking about how we make sure that everyone has access to safe drinking water and a sustainable water supply. We saw the impacts of drought, which is also associated with rising temperatures in the Central Valley. We need to make sure that we're thinking about the workers and communities that are impacted by this transition. And then we need to make sure that our healthcare and public health systems are really ready to take care of people and protect communities, you know, through the things we've already talked about, like, you know, more trees, more parks, green infrastructure. We need to be thinking about how all of the people that are already working in our system, doing home visits, in-home health services, can help make sure that their clients are safe during these emergencies. So there's just a whole host of things that we need to do.
There's a lot of things that can be done and probably ought to be done. I'm glad you mentioned trees too, because there's new data on that that shows a good deal of efficacy in terms of planting more trees and really doing something about climate change. I'm sorry, you're about to say something else, Linda?
Yeah, just that most of the solutions that we have for climate change also bring very, very significant health benefits. So if we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions from using dirty fossil fuels for energy and electricity, we also reduce the significant air pollution that we have all over California that's causing lung disease and heart disease and adverse reproductive outcomes. And if we get people to walk and bike and use public transit, we reduce obesity and diabetes and heart disease from increasing physical activity. So not only do we have solutions for the climate problem, if we can build the political and social will to actually implement them across the country and around the world, but these solutions have health benefits that are very important to our communities now.
Okay, we're coming up on a break, and I also want to point out the Union of Concerned Scientists also points out that we can really help the economy by cutting carbon emissions. Again, a point that needs to be emphasized. We'll hear from more of you when we return and remind you that we're talking about a new report called Killer Heat from the Union of Concerned Scientists. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. There's a new report out by the Union of Concerned Scientists, which really details how extreme heat will affect the Bay Area and actually throughout the contiguous United States. And let me remind you who is with us. Linda Rudolph is Senior Advisor on Climate Change and Health with the Public Health Institute, and Molly Peterson is Science Reporter for KQED News. And Dr. Christina Dahl here in studio with us is Senior Climate Scientist with Climate and Energy Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists and lead author of this study. Let me go to more of our callers, and let's go to Cole next. Cole, join us. You're on the air.
Thank you, Michael. This is really a great program, as always. I was going to bring up the idea that that this climate issue is going to bring out the meanness in people because, you know, as resources dwindle and things are hotter, you can just definitely tell that that's the way that people are going to react in a lot of ways. But that was already brought up. But I wanted to also bring a parallel to the idea that basically what we're seeing at the southern border is this refugee crisis, where people are doing whatever they have to do to save their families. And I could wonder, you know, when I would talk to people about this was, like, what would you do if your family was put in that position, you know, if you were living in middle America and all of a sudden something happened where you had to move? And I'm seeing that this climate problem that we are talking about right now, this heat issue, I mean, what if the majority of Texas had to move because it was 130 degrees? Where are those people going to go? And I press for the idea of empathy for your fellow person, not necessarily your fellow citizen. But, you know, like, what if the state of Oregon shut down its borders, you know, to the people in a neighboring state that had to move? And I just really wish that people would think about the kindness of this, you know, and that, you know, we're all going to have to deal with this unless we
always welcome a call that makes us think more about kindness. Thank you for that. Good to hear from you and appreciate the call. Let me, before I take more calls, go back to you, if I may, Molly Peterson. Molly Peterson, again, is a science reporter for KQED News. I'm just wondering what kind of laws have been passed locally to address these issues. Like, for example, is there an outdoor work rule now, Molly?
Well, in California, there is an outdoor work rule. There are efforts to make a national heat standard that's protective for workers with federal OSHA. And beginning last year and through this year, we've been covering efforts in California to make worker standards for indoor workplaces as well. And some of those are places that you wouldn't necessarily expect. And it's not just, you know, Amazon warehouses in the Inland Empire in Southern California. We're talking about, you know, food assembly, like meal kit assembly facilities in the Central Valley, canneries. We're talking about office buildings where they turn off air conditioning. And so there are people working in office buildings that don't have cooling in them. Even people who work cleaning planes and work on the tarmacs and in airports. So in car washes in urban areas. So this is something that really is already touching people in all of these places. Figuring out that workplace standard has been particularly challenging for indoor. California is still one of the first states to even have an outdoor standard. And the fact that there is discussion about this at the federal level right now, driven in part by a petition from Public Citizen, but also Congresswoman Judy Chu has introduced some legislation, I think is very interesting.
And again, Molly Peterson, a science reporter for KQED News. And our next caller is Linda from San Jose. Linda, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, Michael, thank you so much for having this program. This is really the most important thing we could be talking about, and I hope you'll consider doing a weekly program on the topic of the climate crisis. I have three quick points to make. The first is about our language. The Guardian has chosen to change its languaging around what we used to call climate change. They're now using the phrase global heating because climate change just seems so innocuous. And people say, oh, the climate's always changing. So they're using the phrase global heating and the climate crisis. And second, I want to echo what one of the previous speakers said about the need to build a political will. As a mother, I have two young daughters, and I am really scared for their future. But I've realized that taking individual action is not enough. We need to work together to get the political will through joining an organization like the Union of Concerned Scientists or like my group, Mothers Out Front, where ordinary citizens can come together and work in focused campaigns to make change. And I just want to give a shout out to all the parents out there who, like me, are really scared for your kids' future. Come together with other parents and make the change that we need. In San Jose, the Mothers Out Front South Bay team was named the Climate Smart Champions of the Year. We've had a big impact with a small group, and we need more moms, more dads, more grandparents, more teachers to get involved. And finally, I want to say that there's going to be a global strike for climate action. Folks have probably heard of it, but not everyone. Please put it on your calendars, everybody. September 20th to 27th. Around the world, there are going to be strikes for climate action. And Greta Thunberg, the young 16-year-old climate activist from Sweden, has asked adults now to step up, not just youth striking for the climate, but adults. So I hope everybody will take action together.
Linda, thank you so much. Good to hear from you. Appreciate your call. And let me go back, if I may, to you, Dr. Dahl. Christina Dahl here with us in studio, senior climate scientist for the Union of Concerned Scientists. What do you think about this change of language, global heating, climate crisis?
I think it's a really excellent change. For a long time, people have criticized the terms global warming or climate change as not fully characterizing this magnitude of the problem and the scope of the problem. And so as we move forward and into this coming decade that's so critical in terms of our response to this crisis and how we change our emissions over the next 12 years, it's really critical that we start thinking about the language we're using so that the public is aware of how the scientific community sees this issue.
And we'll bring more callers on. And let me go next to Helen. Helen, welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Michael. Thanks so much for doing this program. I just want to follow up on the caller from San Jose and say that joining a group is really important right now. I haven't most of my life, and I'm a mother, and I find myself involved with Extinction Rebellion. A lot of people haven't heard of them yet. They closed down London for 11 days and got the parliament to declare a climate emergency, and there is a group in San Francisco and all over the country and internationally that's working to bring the attention that this is a climate emergency through nonviolent civil disobedience acts that are disruptive but bring home the message that, first, we've got to be telling the truth. The government must tell the truth and declare a climate emergency. We must have zero emissions by 2025, net zero emissions, and we need a citizens' assembly to oversee the new policies. It's about policy changes. Everything that everyone has said in your program is so important and so good, but regular folks like me who are sitting in and saying, but what can I do? Join a group 20th to 27th of September. Put your body out on the street. And if there is enough will, just like the Berlin Wall came down, just like Me Too movement took over, just like all these things that we never believed could happen, it can happen if enough people, regular folks, stand up and say, enough, this has to change.
Helen, I thank you for that call, and go to more calls in just a moment. I want to bring back Molly Peterson, though, science reporter for KQED News. I'd like you sort of to give us some of what came out of your KQED science investigation, Molly. I know you were looking into heat in recent years and Bay Area heat deaths, but also you did a story about how the home can be the most dangerous place during extreme heat.
That's right. During the extreme heat during Labor Day in 2017 in San Francisco, the San Francisco Medical Examiner's Office identified 6 people who died. And most people who died during the extreme heat during 2017, there were kind of 2 incidents in June and September, died at home and died by themselves. I've talked to people in San Francisco in the Department of Public Health and Department of Emergency Management. There's a program out of the city administrator's office called the Neighborhood Empowerment Network that's kind of looking at this too. We're talking about people who maybe in San Francisco, you wouldn't think extreme heat would be a problem, but south-facing hills where people live by themselves, some of those homes have bay windows that really bring that sun and concentrate it right in a room. This is a kind of a different way of thinking about what your community is and how to check on people and how to be concerned about that. We know that heat is a concern on higher floors. We know that heat is a concern where there's no air conditioning. And so over the last several years, I've measured heat in homes in 7 counties to try to figure out what's going on. And largely what I've seen is that houses hold heat overnight, even as temperatures are rising outdoors. So that's compounding the risk for people. It's not just hot during the day, but it's hot at night, and their homes are staying hot, so people are having trouble recovering.
Yeah, according to this report, we're going to have a lot more warmer nights, and we're also going to be, to a great extent, suffering more humidity. I wonder, Linda Rudolph, if I go back to you, what about prevention in all this in terms of health? What are you telling people?
Well, we already talked about some of the things we need to do in our cities and with our laws.
Well, I'm talking about at home, for example.
At home, I think it's important if people can afford air conditioning and they're living in a really hot environment, it's important to make sure that the air conditioner is in working order and that people know that there are programs that assist people with energy costs. If they're low income, people need to know where there are cooling shelters for these extreme heat events and how to get to them. And of course, the agencies that run cooling centers need to make sure that people can access them, have transit, know where to call to get help getting to them. It's important to stay hydrated. It's important during an extreme heat event not to use the stove or oven or do other things that make the house hotter. People can take cool showers to cool down. And then this issue of social cohesion, really trying to make sure that people who are socially isolated, who are at much higher risk have somebody checking on them. I mentioned the importance of the many, many different kinds of home health workers who make visits. They need to understand what to look for in heat and how to help their clients stay cool. But it's important that if you have a friend or a neighbor who's socially isolated or who's unable to get out of the house, to check on them.
You know, I don't want to sound like a naysayer, but I'm afraid when as soon as you mentioned air conditioning, my thought went, and let me go to you on this, Christina Dahl, right to carbon and the concerns we have about carbon.
Absolutely.
Good point.
Relying on increased air conditioning will come with its own challenges. So we'll need to ensure that the power that's running those air conditioners is coming from low carbon sources. And we also, as Linda was just saying, need to be able to make sure that people can afford higher electricity bills. We know that 1 in 3 people in the U.S. already has trouble paying their electricity bills. And certainly with the housing crisis here in the Bay Area and the livability crisis that we have with the cost of living, that's a real concern.
And we'll get some more callers aboard here. Let me go next to you, Tim. You're on. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Just a quick comment, and I want to preface this by saying I'm a 48-year-old gay man, and for most of my life I've been told that I'm a stopgap to population. Now, it's a glaring thing to me that we still think that we can have as many children as we want and that it doesn't impact the environment. So as that stopgap, I want to say stop having children or have a minimum of one child. I believe the Chinese one child policy is brilliant. It's the only way that we are going to curb the amount of pollution on the planet, the amount of waste on the planet. And part of the reason why children are looked on as a blessed event is because in the church, the more children you have, the more money that is given to the church when the children become adults. So it becomes exponential growth, and it's the same thing for corporations. So until we address population control, and again, I think the one child policy is brilliant. Most people are probably booing me right now, but everybody thinks not my child is the problem.
Tim, we're going to let your stopgap statement hold here, and I thank you for it because I want to read a comment from a listener who writes, don't forget the animals. We always talk about how this affects humans. If we wish to keep the natural fauna that we enjoy, we will need to take some rather drastic corrective measures, and it would be quite sad to live in a state with no birds. Let me get Betsy on next. Betsy, join us.
Hi. I've got one quick thing. I'm a retired teacher, so I'm out in the school districts substitute teaching. And there was a couple of days last year in Pleasanton where kids actually couldn't go outside. So I had 2 classes for PE in a bungalow. It was really fun. But we bring up the fact that maybe more trees need to be planted around bus stops and things like that. But please, no more trees. I'm a respiratory survivor of some real hard real difficult allergies, and we've just come out of a drought. So no more trees. Let's think shade structures, okay? That's all I want to say.
Yeah, I think Linda Rudolph wants to speak here. Yeah. Go ahead, Linda.
I'd like to comment that trees have many, many benefits besides shade. Trees help clean the air. They help remove pollution from the air. They help remove carbon from the air. They help to filter our water and recharge our aquifers, which, again, becomes more and more important with increasing drought. And I think we need to just make sure that when we're planting trees, we're doing so carefully. So Los Angeles County, for example, the health department leads a group that's actually looking at how can the concerns about trees from people with asthma be met by planting less allergenic trees and plants and still allowing people to have green space. And trees and greenery are also super important for our mental health and for enhancing children's connectivity to nature. There are other things we should be paying attention to in terms of heat in schools. It's a very important point that the caller raised. Starting with, for example, getting rid of asphalt blacktop playgrounds that just make everything even hotter.
Well, we've got a lot of evidence of the environmental benefits of trees. Of course, the more trees there are, Unfortunately, with climate change, we've got more wildfires, and we have to take that into account as well as part of the equation. But let me indeed thank Betsy for her call and read a comment from David, who says the huge increase, and let me go to you on this, if I may, Christina Dahl, huge increase in use of computers, servers, emails, and electric equipment and chargers of all kinds also contributes to the increase in heat. People have more things plugged in than ever before, and the increase in the use of electricity generates more heat.
That's a really interesting point. You know, as we're increasingly reliant on technology and big data, many of the big tech companies have efforts to make sure that the power that's powering those big data centers is coming from renewable sources. But overall, yes, we need to be reducing our fossil fuel use faster than we even think we can, and converting that to clean energy so that when we are powering all of our devices and our big TVs, that and every car and every truck on the road is getting powered with clean energy.
I'm wondering what your thoughts are on a question which always looms over these kind of discussions. I mean, we always talk about the things that individuals can do and that people can do and that are necessary if we want to fight this battle with that we're having with the climate. But there's also the argument that we also have to do something of a much broader global reach than what we're doing, even in the United States, even if we get tremendous response from citizens. We've got all those corporations that can be concerned about as well.
Absolutely. This is a global problem. But the U.S. has been historically one of the largest contributors to the amount of carbon dioxide that's in our atmosphere today. And so it really is incumbent upon us to help to solve that problem. And right now, what the Trump administration is doing is pulling us back from agreements like the Paris Climate Agreement that signal to the world that we aren't going to be taking action on climate change. So as one of the biggest contributors to the problem, we need to rectify that.
There's a big political argument in this, of course. I'm sure you realize there are those who say, you know, we're going to not make America great and not make America first if we allow other countries to do things and advance with climate, not necessarily being as much a part of their projections as they may be, we hope, for ours.
Yeah, I think we can look to what's happened here in California in recent years. We've been able to dramatically reduce our carbon emissions and increase our reliance on clean energy while having one of the most booming economies in the country.
California remains a beacon in this way, and I'm very proud of what we've been able to do in this state. Let me get another caller on here, though, and that's you, Helena. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, thank you so much for this show, and I'm really happy with how the panel is talking about the interconnectedness of the issues. There is going to be a hearing about the climate emergency plan in San Francisco this Monday, July 22nd at 1:30 p.m. at City Hall in room 250 of City Hall.
I get your day straight, Helen. Yeah.
Six days from today, Monday, July 22nd at 1:30 p.m. And we know that a successful response to the climate emergency requires a holistic rather than a piecemeal approach. And we need to ask, those of us in San Francisco, we need to ask our government to work on projects that maximize public impact on health, safety, and livelihoods, especially for vulnerable communities.
All right, Helen, I thank you for that call. And I'm going to go back to our science reporter, Molly Peterson. Molly, question from Ben. He says, is there any chance that cap-and-trade funding could be redirected at heat mitigation measures as extreme heat becomes a more significant challenge? How about state guidelines and regulations limiting roof sizes and materials which increase the urban heat island effect?
I mean, I mentioned earlier, Los Angeles has a cool roofs ordinance, which will completely transform the rooftops of Los Angeles. It'll take an entire generation, though. It's an excellent point that right now the cost of cooling has been placed on, in some cases, the most vulnerable people in California. We're talking about, you know, homes that I've seen in Contra Costa County and Los Angeles County, where poor people, renters who are living in, you know, densely in single family homes in greater than single family numbers, trying to cool themselves with the window air conditioners for which they pay exorbitant bills. And there's got to be some way to think about that differently. But what we're talking about is, you know, something maybe more related to investor-owned utilities, energy efficiency programs. Is there a way to make heat pumps more accessible for commercial housing or multifamily housing so that there's a more efficient way to cool homes than what we're using right now?
Let me ask you another question, Molly, from another listener. Adam wants to know, and perhaps you can provide some detail on this, what these projections mean for agriculture in California.
I mean, that's a really complicated question because we're also at that point forecasting how much water is in our soil and what kind of crops we're going to have. But we are transforming, heat is transforming, you know, the agricultural region of California already. Something that's significant I think we can talk about is that it makes air quality worse and makes heat worse for people who work in the fields. So we talked a little bit about, you know, the secondary effects of heat being wildfires. What we haven't talked as much about is the fact that heat cooks ground-level ozone and makes smog worse and makes air quality worse. And in a place like the Central Valley, that's going to be a threat multiplier for people who already are vulnerable to asthma and cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, it's a big problem. And Christina Dahl, can you flesh this out a little bit more for us?
Absolutely. So the Central Valley is one of the hottest places in the state today, and our analysis shows that it's highly exposed to extreme heat in the future. The Central Valley will be one of the first areas in California that we project will see an increase in what we call off-the-charts heat days. These are days when the combination of temperature and humidity creates conditions so hot that they exceed the National Weather Service's ability to actually calculate a heat index. So in places like the Central Valley, we are going to have agricultural workers increasingly exposed to this off-the-charts level of heat. And it's in a region.
We also have problems with pure drinking water down there, too, unfortunately.
Absolutely. It intersects with a lot of other societal issues, such as poverty, exposure to poor air quality, as Molly was saying.
And Eric writes, it's 9 a.m. and already 100 degrees in Palm Springs. My family is used to the hot desert summers, but will Palm Springs and the southwest region become more humid with a substantial increase in humidity? 115 degrees will be unlivable. Christina?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't have the numbers in front of me for Palm Springs specifically, but
you can go to the map, though.
You can go to our map at ucsusa.org/killerheat and check out the projections for your area.
And we'll put that on our website. I'm sorry, what were you saying?
I was just going to say that Palm Springs is at the edge of the Sonoran Desert, which Christina knows is going to be, parts of it are going to be that off-the-charts heat. So the multiplier for humidity, I think, is rising a little bit.
And here's David joining us from Berkeley. David, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I applaud all the political ideas, and I just wanted to make a pitch for doing something on your own property. I'm a landscaper, and I've learned with environmental design that you can do a lot with choosing a good plant and putting it in the right place, shading the west side of the house, layering with overstory, understory. All those plants that are, evaporating moisture are actually cooling the environment. And then also, if it's possible, just to direct your downspouts onto your soil and keep it so that it doesn't just rush off into the street. The more humidity, the more moisture that you have in the ground.
David, good practical advice. Thank you for those pieces of advice. Appreciate that. And I'm going to get another caller on here, and that's Gracie from Napa, where according to the study we're talking about, there's going to be 90-degree heat in the next 2 months a year. Gracie, welcome.
Hello. Yeah, I've been hearing everybody talk about so many good ideas, and I know I hate using the word veganism because it automatically makes everybody break down, but the biggest single impact that a person can make for climate crisis right now would be to have a more flexible diet or to be vegan, which would dramatically change the agriculture that we provide for our citizens in the United States and all of the world. So if you could have your guests talk a little bit more about, you know, veganism and the impact that our diet makes on climate crisis that we're dealing with.
Yeah, it's an important point, and I thank you for it. And, of course, we've done programs on that, and we'll probably look at that more in the future because it does impact to a great extent. I want to go to something else, though, Christina Dahl. Looking at the map, this came up a little earlier, expect people can be moving, especially in places that are relatively cooler, like the Bay Area. I mean, it's a shift to where people can live. You have some thoughts about that?
Yeah, we don't yet know what people will be able and willing to endure in terms of extreme heat.
But we're going to have more climate refugees, so to speak.
You know, you can imagine a lot of people, particularly in the southern half of the country, deciding that this level of heat is too uncomfortable,
it's
too dangerous, yeah. It's too puts too much of a risk for your occupation. We know from research that's been done in Mexico that there's been a migration out of some rural areas as a result of the fact that the increase in heat is affecting agricultural employment.
Well, we do I'm sorry, you had something to add to that?
Many of the parts of Central America where we're seeing the exodus of people to our borders now are, in fact, climate refugees because that part of the world has seen terrific increase in drought, and it does basically make it impossible for people to have agricultural livelihoods. They have no choice. And of course, it's compounded by violence and other factors, but climate change is a piece of it.
We're going to have to leave it there. Linda Rudolph, thank you. Linda Rudolph, again, is on Climate Change and Health, Public Health Institute. We also thank Molly Peterson for being with us, KQED News science reporter, and Dr. Christina Dahl, who's here in studio, senior climate scientist and the lead author on the report, Killer Heat, which is on our website. You can get it there. Thank you for being with us this hour. Another hour of Forum is up ahead. We're going to talk about a strange new currency, Libra, and we're also going to talk about what's happening with amnesty and a new rule put out by the Trump administration. That's up ahead. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.